Hi, this is Justin Ruffmarsh, author of The Machine, and you're listening to The SaaS Holes.
Welcome to The SaaS Holes, a show dedicated to issues within the software as a service industry. Jamie, Jason, and Pete have a combined 100 years of making mistakes, just like this intro, and are more than happy to share them with you. Please rate us on 5 stars on Apple Podcasts and smash that like button on Facebook, Instagram, and follow us on Twitter. Today, we are joined with a very special guest, Justin Ruffmarsh, author of The Machine and founder of Holistics. Before we get to Justin, we have an ad. All right. This episode is brought to you by NeuroNoodle. Get a doodle of your noodle, which is a brain map, to find out why you're having anxiety and panic attacks. Just mention this ad, and you'll get 50% off. Visit NeuroNoodle.com. Mention Jamie Carney and get 5% off. Joke of the day, Carney.
Yes, Pete. I believe I gave you the joke of the day, and it's bad. Yes, Pete.
Carney. Yes. All right, back with the joke of the day. I was going to talk about the Suez Canal, but that ship has sailed. Leave us some comments on our blog at sassholes.net. Shoutouts.
Last week the Suez Canal was a news item. This week it's a joke.
Yep,
that's fantastic. You know, the news cycle moving even faster now.
Well, that's what happens when you get Carney feeding you jokes.
Topical. He's topical.
How many different people take credit for my jokes? You got Justin Jackson. You got Carney. Who was the other person that came? Oh, Patrick Kennedy.
We're not allowed to talk about either of those guys.
Oh, really? Okay. Shout outs. Jennifer Higgins, knowledge manager at Peapod Digital Labs. That's a new gig for her. I used to use Peapod. Let's see.
Still existed.
Okay. Kim Fall, Kimberly Ferris Fall, VP Sales at Salesforce. She was just named the new caucus president of Lake Forest. She'll be happy to know she was mentioned on this episode. And then we have Nancy Gray Starkelbaum. Nancy Gray Starkelbaum, VP of Customer Success at Phenom People. We'd love to have you on, Nancy. Come on anytime. All right. News.
I got a shout out.
Oh, whoa.
Hey, somebody dead.
No.
He died.
Not at all. Not this week. Two. I got my wife, Jennifer Ferrara, who
love Jennifer.
New job as an account manager at MuleSoft.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Congrats.
Big time. And then two, I want to, because Pete, you keep calling me the marketing.
Is that the bus company that Salesforce bought? Is that MuleSoft?
Integration company.
Enterprise
yeah.
Bus?
Yeah. APIs. Yes.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Yep. Okay. Exactly. And then the other one, because Pete, you keep calling me the marketing guru, I want to give a shout out to John Ellett, who wrote an amazing book called The CMO Manifesto. If you're interested in marketing and you want to figure out how the CMO thinks, read The CMO Manifesto. Those are my two.
I think we need him on the show.
Yeah, can do. I'll work it.
Carney, you got anything over there? You've been swamped. I know it's tax season.
Matt Lorenas, give him a shout out. He just got promoted to chief experience officer at Blue Crew. So he's one of the hardest working guys I know, a little bit too intense, but he's still a good guy. And then Sarah Capulli just got promoted over at Relativity. If you don't know what Relativity is,
that's
a good thing. What they do is.
I have a theory though.
They look at all chats made for lawsuits. It was one of their primary products. So any type of communication you do, they will look at it for either lawsuit protection or to sue somebody.
Outstanding. Matt Lorenas, my favorite planet. Love that dude. Glad he's landed on his feet. Any other news of notes, gentlemen? Because I know people are on the edge of their seats. No, that's it. Crickets. Okay. Insert crickets there. Okay.
Germany just went into its third lockdown.
Yeah, so did France.
France. I was listening to some of Justin's podcasts that he or videos that he was on where they talked about COVID and stuff like that. But a delay in pipeline creation and stuff like that over the last year, I feel like COVID is still hitting a lot of companies that might feel like they survived.
We're talking about this, and this is my first day post 2 weeks after my second Pfizer shot. I'm clean, man. I am clean. But I still have to go wear a mask or I freak everybody out. I'm going to a football game tonight. I got to wear a mask. We got a lot of that going on. All right.
I think we need to start desensitizing the general population.
Yes.
Oh,
start taking those masks off, I think.
Yes, I agree. Justin, I'm on your side. Let's do it gradually
as a public service. Take, you know, it's like if you're scared of spiders, they'll have you hold a little one to begin with.
Well, a lot of people are going to be surprised when I take my mask off. This is
now, Justin, that's a horrible analogy because no matter how many spiders I handle, I am still scared to death of them.
All right. On that note, we have Justin Roth Marsh, author of The Machine and founder of Ballistics, on the show. Oh, my goodness. This is a big show. Justin, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, man, how could we not have you? I don't know how many books I've bought of yours. I don't know how many times we brought you in, once or twice. I can't remember. I think it was maybe it was when how long has Ballistics been around?
25 years,
wow. Right? From day one. Okay. I got a hold of your book, read it, digested it. I don't know how many times I read it, dissected it, brought you in to help teach sales process engineering. What is sales process engineering, Justin? I think that's what the basis of the book is, right? Sales process engineering?
Yeah. So the essence of sales process engineering is very simple. It's the idea that it makes sense to apply division of labor to the sales function in a principled way. And the reason why I add that bit about principles is that the sales environment is unique for two reasons. First, you don't have division of labor, but then everyone claims you do. So what you actually have in the sales environment is no division of labor in a principled way, but what you have is a bunch of folks with different business cards. But the interesting thing is when you scratch underneath the surface, you realize that there are no clear demarcation lines, which of course is the hallmark of division of labor. So for example, if you talk to someone in customer service and you ask them, well, what are you responsible for? They'll say, well, I'm responsible for, you know, performing the transactions that are associated with revenue, but then they're only responsible in a limited sense, because if something goes wrong or if the customer wants a discount or if ultimately the salesperson's responsible. And the same thing applies with marketing. Marketing folks will say, well, among other things, we're responsible for generating leads for salespeople, but ultimately salespeople think of themselves as responsible for generating their own leads. And they'll look at the bundle that marketing gives you and they'll flick through them skeptically and then go back to Navigator and generate their own. So you have this thin veneer of specialization, but in even the more modern sales environments, you don't have division of labor in a principled sense. And that's what we're arguing for.
Well, is that due primarily to the fact of a lack of trust too? Like, I think in certain situations where leads are handed over to a rep just doesn't believe in half of them because they've had a couple bad experiences with a little bit.
Yeah, so there's a chicken and egg problem. Is the problem with the rep because they don't trust marketing, or is the problem with marketing because they've never been forced to align themselves correctly with the rep's requirements? I mean, on the side of marketing, most marketing departments we come across today have accepted an impossible mandate. You know, it's impossible for them to generate sales opportunities at the rate at which salespeople consume them if they buy into the inbound dogma. It's simply impossible. So they've been dealt a fairly ugly hand. So in that situation, sales doesn't want marketing to have absolute responsibility for the generation of sales opportunities, but marketing doesn't want to have absolute responsibility for the generation of them either.
That's finger pointing both ways then, is what that creates.
Yeah, so the problem is that nobody has started from first principles and applied themselves to properly engineering or re-engineering the sales function.
I mean, Pete, I think that makes tremendous sense to me. And you and I had that issue when we worked together, right? And the way that we solved that, well, I don't know if we solved it, but the way that we coexisted and were successful is because we spent a lot of time together. What do you need? What do you want? What do I need? What do I want? And I mean, we've talked about this a number of times on the SaaS Holes. There's an interlock between sales, marketing, and marketing client success, and you know, those groups that say, like, we have to have these shared understandings. Otherwise, it doesn't matter what we're doing. You know, we can pump out all the content and we can drive all the pipeline, but unless we're connected on it, it doesn't matter. And I think that's where teams get really successful. And that's the example, I think, Peter, if you and I just arguing isn't necessarily a bad word. We just argued about what we were there to do. You know, we finally got a shared understanding.
I think the broader point is that what we're talking about is a design problem, an organizational design problem. So James asked who's responsible. Well, I would say it's not sales, it's not marketing, it's whoever's responsible for the design of the organization, which presumably is the senior executive. Now, you can compensate for an organizational design problem by going to enormous effort to have, you know, folks get in a room and talk to each other, but you shouldn't have to. It makes more sense to design the organization so it's functional by default, rather than designing the organization so it's dysfunctional and then expecting individual contributors and middle management to attempt the impossible on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, but Justin, you should just be able to hire good people and they'll figure it out.
Well, you can. The problem is that doesn't scale.
well, it does, but just under 12. If you have a company under 12.
Yeah, exactly. You can build big, great businesses as long as they have fewer than 12 employees.
Now, getting back to why marketing sucks, I think the way I took it back when Jason and I worked together, let's just say a sales rep costs $100,000. If you could spend $100,000 on marketing and you could have business come in that would far outweigh the $100,000, then you wouldn't need a salesperson. It's which is more effective. There's got to be some points where marketing doesn't make sense and it makes sense to bring on a sales rep. It's figuring out what those numbers are. The biggest take that I got from Justin's book, one of them was specialization of labor. Take the people that you have and whatever they're best at, make sure they're doing the most that they can as long as they're supposed to be there. So like whoever, quote unquote, the best sales rep is, you know, if they're going to work 40 hours a week, well, I want them spending 40 hours influencing, you know, business. And that's kind of where we got into the discussion of BDRs, business development reps, you know, should they create the interest and then pass it over right away over to the, to the reps that have the skill? I know that's where Justin and I got into it. What's your take on that, Justin? Because I know you're shy.
Yeah. Have you guys, I'm in therapy. Have you guys ever seen that movie, The Boiler Room?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So Salesforce and HubSpot people and their followers talk about this BDR or SDR, I think is the other one. They talk about this idea as if it's new, as if they thought it up, and it's bull crap. If you watch The Boiler Room from the 70s or whenever that was, what you see is exactly that concept. You got a bunch of 22-year-old nincompoops making large volumes of calls. And when they get interested individuals on the line, they pass them across to closers who, that's exactly the concept. And it's a perfect example of what Deming called sub-optimization. It's where you optimize one part of a process and sub-optimize the performance of the process as a whole. So if you're trying to improve sales and you're trying to solve for salesperson efficiency, then BDRs make a lot of sense. But if you're trying to solve for how much money you cart off to the bank, BDRs or SDRs make no sense at all, because their existence, particularly in environments where you're selling more complex deals to discerning individuals, is premised upon the idea that at the beginning of a sales conversation, what we're trying to do is qualify the prospect to determine whether or not they're worthy to be handed off to a intelligent human. And of course, the customers who you most want to sell to are those that are going to be least tolerant of having some 22-year-old nincompoop trying to qualify them. So it makes no sense to create this artificial distinction between selling and qualification, because ultimately the prospect to whom you're talking, from their perspective, everything is selling. And if they're talking to a 22-year-old idiot, then it's really bad selling and they're not going to tolerate it. So if you want to sell expensive stuff to half intelligent people, you need to have your best salespeople having the initial conversation. If you want to improve the efficiency of your best salespeople, don't take away the initial conversation. Take away all the other crap they shouldn't be doing and put them in a situation where they do nothing other than selling conversations, you know, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. And in most organizations, they will have capacity coming out of their ears. You don't need SDRs.
And is that dependent on the size of the ideal customer profile? You know, if I'm selling or the size of the thing that I'm selling. So if it's enterprise or large dollar amount, or do you think differently about it if it's, you know,
I do. If you're selling something that's large enough and significant enough that it makes sense to have salespeople, you shouldn't have SDRs. If you're selling something that's small enough that there's an argument for SDRs, then guess what? There's no argument for the salespeople. You should shut the whole damn thing down and give them money back to your customers in the form of everyday lower prices.
With what you just said on the whole SDR, you should have sales reps do it and strip out all the pieces that a sales rep is doing besides selling. My question on that is how? Because I feel like a lot of these seasoned reps, what happens, what they do, they tend to migrate into is they've run into an issue with their solution engineer or their sales engineer or their customer service with one of their clients. And now they got involved to save it. And now they apply that same thing across the board.
So you can't solve this problem at the rep level. You have to solve this problem at the organizational level. So when we go in and work in an organization, if let's say we work with a company for a year, which is common, the smallest volume of work is with the sales team. Most of the work, like 9 months out of 12 months, will be spent working with customer service, rebuilding the customer service team, rebuilding the design engineering team, rebuilding procurement, so that salespeople are in a position where they can focus exclusively on selling conversations. You can't go into a typical organization and say and front up to the sales team and say, hey, there's a new modus operandi moving forward. The consequences would be catastrophic. The rest of the organization has been implicitly designed around the assumption that salespeople have their fingers in everything. And as a consequence, these other functions are not capable of functioning without the involvement of salespeople.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a problem that almost every organization has. Right. Because as they start small, they've got their hands in every single facet of the company because there are 12 people. It's not scalable. When you start growing more than that, though, some of those guys that were there at the beginning are your best sales reps because they're the most knowledgeable. But their propensity, they're typically wanting to be involved in everything.
But what you need to recognize is there's a point in time where they cease to be sales reps, because what happens if you look at the evolution of a small firm? Somebody will start out picking up the phone and selling in a traditional sense, you know, hustling for business. Mm-hmm. And then that person will end up with a bunch of accounts. And then that person becomes focused on looking after the revenue that those accounts produce. So at some point in time, they transition silently without anyone noticing from being a salesperson into being a very expensive customer services rep. Okay. And salespeople think it's honorable to walk around saying, well, I own all these accounts, and it's BS. All it means is you're an overpaid mobile customer service rep. If you took sales seriously, you wouldn't own any accounts. You would insist that you only went to work for organizations that were mature enough to build operational capability that made your ownership of accounts unnecessary. That way you could focus on selling.
Completely aligned here. That's exactly what I say on my own a lot of times. They're overpaid account reps or account managers.
Well, customer service reps.
Customer service reps. Yeah, I had some of the best reps come to me at previous companies and say, I'm sitting with my accounts and they are asking me 25 questions every single month of things we can answer. And I'm like, great, answer the two that we can't. Stop focusing on the 23 that we can't. We can sell these two. We can solve these two problems. Yep. Don't focus on everything else. And instead, they'd spend all this time trying to focus on the other 23. And it would just drive me nuts.
Yeah.
Well, who should own the sales rep's calendar?
We used to say, sales reps should be field-based and give their calendar to someone else to manage for them. But we haven't been advocating that now for, I don't know, 15 years. And everyone thought we were idiots, and then COVID came along, and this has been our busiest year in history. And it's because everyone realized that even though we are idiots, generally speaking, we happen to be correct on this point. Your sales team should be inside. They shouldn't be in the field.
Yeah, it's a waste of time.
Now, it's true that there are activities that need to be performed as part of the pursuit of a sale in the field, But turns out that those activities, for the most part, shouldn't be performed by salespeople. So if you think about the activities that typically need to be, genuinely need to be performed face-to-face, it's detailed requirement discovery and demonstrations. Salespeople shouldn't be doing either of those things. Engineers should be doing those things.
It is pretty amazing how when we were selling through the pandemic at Outmatch, how many sales that we would have said, oh, you got to go see those people. Oh, you got to get in the field to see those people, actually closed without being face to face. It was eye opening for us as to how much money got spent in that let me go see somebody effort that frankly then got repurposed either to nothing. We saved it. Or we were able to invest in education of our reps to say, well, instead of thinking that you're missing out on not being there in person, here are all the opportunities that you have in front of you. That was
lazy salespeople think that in order to sell, they have to go and develop a personal relationship, but that's bullcrap. In order to sell, you have to give someone a compelling commercial proposition and you have to communicate it effectively. And if you have to go and sit face to face with them in order to communicate a compelling proposition, then you're obviously a shitty communicator and you shouldn't be on the sales team in the first place.
Do you have strong feelings about this, Justin, or do you want to restate that in a little stronger language at all?
I think I nailed it on the first go.
One of the chapters, death of field sales, man. You had that down before COVID.
So I have an advantage over a lot of folks, particularly in Silicon Valley, because when I started Ballistics years ago, a lot of our initial clients were mining and heavy industrial. So we worked with Outotec out of Helsinki, which was a multi-billion dollar, well, still is, I'm sure, multi-billion dollar mining company. We worked with Russell Mineral Equipment in Toowoomba, Australia, which was $100+ million manufacturer of what were essentially these robotic mining machines, and number of other similar cases. And what we discovered from the get-go is if you're selling really expensive pieces of custom engineered kit, where the deal value is north of $1 million, your sales team is inside. So that was kind of one of our first experiences of sales. If we just finished an engagement with Stas in Canada, they sell heavy equipment into aluminum smelting operations. They're in northern Quebec. They sell all over the world, including the Middle East when they're allowed to. And their sales team sits in northern Quebec. The biggest sales challenge they have is finding people in Quebec who speak good English. Because it turns out the rest of the world speaks English when it comes to making major industrial purchases. And there's no reason to be face-to-face, not for a salesperson. You may want to send engineers to go face-to-face. But if you're selling in an industrial environment, $1 million+ transactions, and you send a salesperson to go and visit with a customer, your customer's going to think that you got rocks in your head.
So, Justin, if somebody's going to hire you to come in, let's give you a little plug here. Sell your services. What would it look like? They call you up and you come in. You evaluate the situation. What do you do? I know what it was for me the couple of times we brought you in. What do you do currently?
Well, we start with a workshop with the senior executive team. And the question we ask in the workshop is if we were to start with a clean sheet of paper and redesign the organization from scratch so that it would grow faster, what would it look like? Notice I'm saying the organization, not the sales function. So if we were to re-engineer the organization for aggressive growth and we had the opportunity to start with a clean sheet of paper, how exactly would we engineer it? And we worked through a process of mapping out the structure of the organization. And then at the end of that workshop, we asked the question, well, do we want to build this or do we want to just put it in the bottom drawer as evidence of an interesting intellectual discussion we had years ago?
Now, the people that hire you on, aren't they in dire straits, or I would say dire straits, but I mean, no. It's like what I've seen is people think they know it all. Cause anytime you try to bring in a consultant, it's like, well, why don't we have the knowledge here to be able to do this? That's the first obstacle. If we knew,
knowing how is the easy part.
Yeah.
It's like, you know,
knowing when
I just bought it. Well, no, it's how I think I just bought well, sorry, it's not just knowing how, or it's having the experience of doing it. I just bought a HVLP spray setup. So I'm a bit of a woodworker on the side. And conceptually, spraying paint is extremely simple. But if you want to get a feel for how complex it is, go and buy an HVLP spray setup and have a crack at respraying your car and see what the end result looks like. So the reason why folks hire us is not because they don't understand what the end state looks like. We've already run a workshop for them and showed them what the end state looks like. It's not even that it's theoretically impossible for them to make the transition. It's not. All of our clients are smart enough to make the transition themselves. It's just that they understand that if they try to do it themselves, they have to fumble through. It's going to take a long time. And it's going to be a distraction from a lot of other important stuff. Whereas if they have us come and do it, we have a team of people who run these transitions time after time in three different continents. And we can do it quickly. And you're going to get a more professional result on the first attempt.
Why are some organizations more hesitant than others to bring a consultant like yourself in? Do you even call yourself a consultant? I mean, because that's all.
I like to think of our organization as a building company. We go into organizations and we build stuff. We go in, we build stuff, we leave. And I think that's a much healthier model. But unfortunately, I have to call ourselves a consulting firm because there's no word, for companies that go into organizations, build infrastructure and leave again. I guess they are called. That's what probably Deloitte and Accenture do, and they tend to be called consulting firms.
At a few companies, I've seen them be very resistant, or they're insecure, I think is the right word, of bringing somebody like you in because they're worried that they will be exposed, that they don't know what they're doing. Why do Ferraris, have you seen that or picked up that vibe anywhere? Arnie, why is that happening?
I think it's exactly that. I think, the biggest thing out there is benchmarking, right? Inside your own company, you think you know, but you're scared of what really is out there. When I benchmark myself against other companies like me, am I really doing well? Because right now I'm touting myself and I'm patting myself on the back and I'm selling upstream to everyone of how great we're doing. But once you get the benchmarking in there, that's when you realize you might be the tallest midget. I think the same thing happens with your organizational structure and performance, and the fact that I might think SDRs and BDRs are a great example, but when I bring somebody else in, they might say, you just wasted, $800,000 on building up this SDR function, and it's got to go away. And the senior leadership executive is going to take the fall for that and is going to take a slap on the wrist if it's, or maybe lose his job.
We don't have much success working for companies where the founder is not in charge. So a typical, or maybe an ideal client for us is in the sort of $100 to $300 million range, with the founder still either in charge or sitting in the background, paying careful attention to what's going on. We try and avoid, large corporations that have salaried CEOs, because it's very difficult to drive change into those organizations for the reasons that you suggest. I think I should point out that most organizations do not work with us. Only a very tiny percentage of companies work with us. And almost without exception, it's where the CEOs read the book and they've said, fuck it. The existing sales function is clearly flawed. It's clearly not scalable. We want to go from 100 million to 150 or 250 million. And our current sales function is not going to take us there. And I've read the book and the book clearly makes sense. We're going to do this. And that's a starting point for most of our engagements. It's never a committee.
Well, the other thing, because I like that idea a lot, where you just say, okay, well, I think something's broken here. Let's go fix it. I mean, I tell people a lot too, in terms of bringing someone in from the outside to help, or at least the way you benchmark and start, is go get the key metrics, the key learnings, the insights that you need to take that next step. And I'll tell you right now, you're not going to like what you find.
Yeah.
So it isn't to me, and this is probably an enlightened leadership team that could do this, which is, I got all the information I need. I don't like what I found. Rather than sit there and say, so-and-so is not doing their job, or it's a company issue. It's a leadership team problem to solve. And so then you say, well, I don't like the answer that I got. So how do I organize my business or the structure or whatever the problem you're trying to solve is in order to get the results that I want and the things that make me happy. And so, and then make the business grow. So, you know, I think in terms of like consultants and stuff, the challenge becomes when leadership teams are not willing to say, yeah, we asked them to solve the problem, but then when we found out the answer, we didn't like it. So we got rid of everything. Like, you have to power through that. I'm not going to like it. I know that. So let's benchmark and go rather than, you know, benchmark and like just get pissed and stick our head in the sand.
I think that when an organization gets large above a certain size, the key to success is maintaining the status quo, business as usual. And there's value in that. If it's a $2 billion business, you don't need every smart ass with a new idea to be given free rein to mess with a proven business model. So my approach would be to try and avoid those types of businesses. If they're in dire straits and they hire in a transformational leader, then sure, we're interested. If they get bought by private equity, then we're interested, because of course, if they get bought by private equity, the CEO is not actually in charge. There's someone else in the background who's an economic decision maker. So yeah, we definitely will get involved then. But my solution to convincing large companies to change is it's not my job. Someone else can try and do that. It's a fool's errand as far as I'm concerned.
So would you say you mainly work then with either smaller, medium-sized companies or PE-owned companies?
Yeah, so medium to large, privately owned or PE-owned companies, mostly industrial. I'm a big fan of software. I've kept a close eye on what's happened in software, and we've had some large software clients. In fact, the world's largest software company on a price earnings basis has been a client of ours on and off for the last 10 years.
Wow.
A company out of Australia no one's ever heard of, but we do most of our work with industrial clients because they're just easier to work with. And you guys will hate me for saying this, but they tend to have more mature management than technology companies.
Oh, sure. I mean, that's one of the challenges of a technology company, like to get one started and then to get one to sustain and grow, you have to bring in some experience somewhere along the line.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you know, it's like,
the problem with startups is you have sometimes hyper-intelligent people with no common sense, or you have idiots who think they're hyper-intelligent and who still have no common sense. Because of a lack of experience in heavy industry, we're working with folks who are intelligent, who are humble, intelligent, with decades of experience. And oftentimes with organizations that have really, really good fundamentals, they have what Silicon Valley would call product market fit. And it's much, much easier for us to drive growth for an organization like that than it is a startup with questionable product market fit and a bunch of cocky recent college grads running amok.
I think that gets to strategy too. Like, what is the strategy? So if I guess it doesn't matter the industry. If I have a strategy to build something that serves my customer base, and that's the most important thing to me, it's different than a strategy, which is I'm going to grow this to as much possible revenue as I can in order to transact. Right. So there are two different strategies. And I think if you've got a strategy that's, let me just grow this as fast as I can so I can sell it for as much money, I'm not sure you'd get anywhere with a client like that with what you do. If you have a customer that has a strategy that's how do I maximize the value for my customer, and that's how I'll grow, you know, then that's...
I don't necessarily have a problem with an organization that wants to grow aggressively and sell a shit ton of stuff. I respect that. I'm a capitalist.
That may not be the actual, if the actual point of the business is just to, I guess what I'm saying is to apply your framework to a business whose point is just, I'm going to grow it as big as I can and then sell it.
I think that problem self-corrects. I think it's very difficult, unless you're selling religion or something, it's very difficult to scale past, you know, seed capital, if you don't have a proposition that has some substance behind it. You could point to WeWork, but I think that that's a, there are obviously some, I would say that's an outlier.
Or cult.
The market has lots, generally speaking, the market has lots of options. And if you have a shitty product, they're not going to buy it.
Yeah. I think honestly, what you said there at the beginning was the people that are college grad, inexperienced, that might not have a product market fit, probably need your services more than ever because, and they're probably the ones that you can work with because their product market fit, you'll know if it's a product market fit if you have the sales organization streamlined.
Oh, absolutely. And that's a great point. I mean, one of the problems with the traditional approach to the design of the sales function is it insulates decision makers from the field, and it reduces or it increases the innovation cycle time. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we go into an organization and build an inside sales team, we will say to marketing, look, it's your job to replenish salespeople's opportunity queues on a daily basis. Now, we know that salespeople are going to consume opportunities at the rate of about 10 a day. So if we have an inside sales team with 10 people in it, we need 100 ops a day. Now, in order to generate 100 ops a day, you can't do that with inbound in most cases. So most of those ops need to be outbound. And in order for outbound to work, you need to come up with compelling propositions. In order to come up with compelling propositions, you need to identify market segments that have peculiar requirements that aren't well served by larger competitors. Now, that whole offer formulation piece can't be done by sales or marketing because you don't have folks in those divisions with a mandate that's broad enough to allow them to do that. So the responsibility for offer formulation is forced to shift to the senior executive team. So now we have a situation where we have a group of senior executives sitting around a boardroom table. And we say to those guys, hey, you guys and gals are responsible for coming up with the propositions that are going to breathe life into the sales function. And the success of the sales function is primarily, provided you've done a reasonable job of building the plumbing, the success of the sales function is primarily a function of how good a job those senior executives do of coming up with compelling propositions. Yeah. And the problem is the traditional approach to sales allows senior management teams to dodge that responsibility. Somebody can come up with what seemed like a good idea and pass off responsibility for execution to a sales team, and it can be years before the chickens come home to roost. Whereas with our model, on a monthly basis, we're sitting down and reviewing the results that we got from the last proposition. And we're saying to the senior team, well, we all thought the marketplace was going to take to that one, but they hated it. It sucked. We need a more compelling proposition.
Pay at risk, Justin. Anytime I've ever brought up that we should pay salespeople a flat salary, they say, Pete, you're crazy. Am I crazy or have you changed your tune, Justin?
Well, like I said, we started off working with large industrial companies. In those environments, salespeople are hardly ever paid at risk. They're paid salaries and they're paid good salaries. I think that it depends. It depends how you view your sales function. If you view your salespeople as autonomous or semi-autonomous agents, kind of like, I don't know if you saw that movie, The Founder, it featured Ray Kroc driving around in his jalopy, trying to sell Mixmaster machines out of his trunk.
Yeah, I love that.
If that's your sales model, if you employ a whole bunch of folks who are essentially manufacturer's reps, then I have nothing wrong with at-risk pay because ultimately those people don't really work for you. They're independent agents.
Contractors.
But yeah, they're contractors. It's no different from if you were Dell Computer and you decided to sell some of your machines through Best Buy. Obviously, Best Buy is going to be compensated on a piece rate. It makes obvious sense. But if you actually want your sales function to consist of a bunch of team members who actually play together as a team, and in many cases, it's essential that you do that because if you're selling something complex, you need tight integration between your salespeople and your design engineering team and, you know, customer success or whatever. So if you're in a position where you want your salespeople to be part of a team, then it should be relatively uncontroversial for someone to suggest that maybe you should actually pay them like their team members. And if you don't, you end up with a whole bunch of ugly artifacts that you have to pay people in your organization to fix.
From the book, you say that you should pay them to the level where compensation is no longer an issue. Is that still true?
Well, yes, but I mean, what's sad about this conversation is that it's interesting. It shouldn't be interesting. Imagine if we substituted salespeople for software engineers. Imagine if the radical idea that we were discussing or that we were proposing, somebody was tentatively proposing, is that we pay software engineers at a level that causes them to stop talking about their pay packet and start talking about how to build the algorithms that are required to solve difficult engineering problems. Everyone just checked out of that conversation because it was so freaking boring and self-evident. Why would sales be any different? I mean, people want to ask me why would you get rid of piece rate pay and replace it with salary? And my view is, no, hang on, the onus is on you. You're the one trying to do something that is, you're the one who's trying to do something unusual.
So Carney, could you do that at a company? Could you pay everybody a salary? How would that work?
I don't think we can, just because of the, part of you get hamstrung with the expense model that you have, right? So if you pay everyone a salary and you're expecting only to pay out, 40% commissions, then all of a sudden your P&L changes. And so that's another problem that often happens, I think, in that situation. But I do think it all depends. I mean, if they're hunters, if they're purely hunters, you might want to incentivize, more. If they're account managers, you should pay them.
If they're purely hunters, they don't need to be incentivized because they're hunters, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's their whole
I play thing. Tennis, and there's salespeople who come and play in the evenings after work. Turns out they're competitive on the tennis court, and they're not being incentivized with money. You know why? Because they're competitive.
I get it. I think the problem is you got to get it early, because otherwise when you start getting in multiples and stuff like that, and your EBITDA and your cash EBITDA and all of those earnings.
Well, yeah, it depends how you look at them. If you look at them on a month to month basis, then maybe the numbers will go backwards. But if you look at them on a rolling 12 month basis, then the traditional model's terrible from an EBITDA perspective. Yeah. I mean, it may well be that you view piece rate pay as a hedge against non-performance. But mm-hmm. I've got a question for you, James. Let's say you employ 10 salespeople and all of them appear to be capable because you're not an idiot. You wouldn't have employed the ones that look like deadbeats. Mm-hmm. And every week you check in on them and see how they're going, and all of them have rapidly growing pipelines. How long does it take for you to discover or to determine which of those three or four people you just employed are in fact deadbeats and need to be ejected from the organization?
Oh, it takes easily over a year, probably.
Yeah, it takes a year. So so piece rate pay is only objective for the organization is if you do the reckoning on the first month. If you do the reckoning over the course of a year, it's terrible for the performance of organizations. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we build a sales team, and salespeople do nothing other than selling conversations, and they have 15 to 20 selling, well, they have 10 to 15 selling conversations a day, and they process opportunities at rate of 10 a day, and they sit in a room with a bunch of other salespeople who are doing exactly the same thing, meaning we can benchmark them with one another. We can tell a good salesperson from a deadbeat within weeks, and we eject them from the team within a month. Now, we might have paid them $150,000 a year because that's the market value of someone that has a set of capabilities that we need. But we pay them $150,000 a year for a month.
Here's an interesting twist to that. In North America, that works. But in other countries, with their employment laws and things of that nature, it's not as clean cut as you're saying, right?
Why do you think I moved here?
Because we're global, right? And exiting somebody from Germany, Denmark, Spain, Switzerland is not an easy.
Well, there are ways. I come from Australia where we have a lot of socialist, employment law. There are ways around it. And smart Aussie companies have figured out ways around it. And by the way, we have built US-based sales teams for a lot of a common trick for us with Aussie companies, particularly tech companies, is to say, look, you can have your customer service team in Sydney, but if you want to sell internationally, we're going to build your sales team on the west coast of the States here, because it's a lot easier to sell internationally from the US than it is to sell internationally from Australia.
Wow. Didn't think of that, but that's a good point.
The problem with the socialist countries isn't just the employment law. The leadership teams is the problem. It's not just that the government's socialist; it's that the leadership teams are socialist too. So you can't just blame the environment.
I mean,
some of these companies aren't that keen on making money.
Yeah, that is true, and you know, it's a head scratcher most of the time when I'm looking at performance of other countries and why we're even involved in certain countries. Not the current company I'm at, but the company I was before. I would scratch my head going, "Why are we even there?"
Exactly. Exactly.
Why do we have a presence there?
Thoughts on CRMs, Justin? CRM implementations? Any thoughts?
Well, organizations waste stupid amounts of money. I think that ideally the CRM, in a perfect world, I would say the CRM should be used for one purpose only, and that is the pursuit of new business. So it should be used by the sales team exclusively, and the sales team exclusively should be involved in one thing, and that's pursuing new business. That means winning new accounts and selling new categories of business to existing accounts. Everything other than that should not be done in CRM. It should be done in ERP. Processing orders, generating quotes, you know, engineering and configuring solutions. Everything else should be done in ERP. It makes no sense to move all that operational stuff into a different piece of technology. Now, if you reserve CRM for simply the pursuit of new business, you don't need tight integration between CRM and ERP. You only need a one-way integration of the address book. That's all you need. And you don't need lots of customization. So you can go and buy Salesforce the way it comes, or any Dynamics or Sugar or any enterprise class CRM. And you can avoid the consulting firm that wants to sell you services. And you can simply use it the way it comes out of the box. All you need is to figure out how to do a one-way replication of address book data from ERP into CRM. So, you know, we can get an organization up and running with CRM in a week with no professional services fees. But of course, there's a huge incentive for enterprise technology companies to overcomplicate things. They want to transfer a whole bunch of stuff that should be done in ERP into CRM so that they can write complex integrations between the two, and so that they can spend a fortune trying to replicate the complex data model from ERP into CRM. But and of course we, meaning the business community, are giving them license to do that as a consequence of our complete absence of division of labor. If we recognize that salespeople have nothing to do with revenue, they contribute nothing to revenue. Revenue should be the responsibility of operations. Salespeople's contribution is winning new annuities, winning new business. Now, if organizations recognize that and structured their businesses accordingly, there would be significantly less expenditure on CRM.
I think it's interesting. In one of your talks, you were talking about operations versus sales, and that sort of hits on what you're saying here. Pricing is operations. You know, product issues should be operations. You know, I feel like sales jumps in all of these different avenues, and it bogs them down from selling.
Well, the two pertinent facts here is that for most organizations, 70 to 90% of their revenue in any given reporting period comes from existing customers repurchasing. Now, the second piece of information is if you look at why customers leave, in other words, stop purchasing, the three most common reasons in order are poor operational performance. In other words, you don't deliver your stuff on time. Number two, poor pricing. You're too bloody expensive. And number three is product problems. So either the performance of the product, or they're not happy with the range of products that the organization stocks. They're the top three most common reasons why customers leave. And all of those things are operational responsibilities. Salespeople have nothing to do with any of those things. So if most of your revenue comes from existing customers repurchasing, and if what causes existing customers to continue repurchasing are operational factors, then why the hell do we think that salespeople should be responsible for revenue in the first place?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a great point to say, like, if I'm a customer of a company and my rep leaves, almost never is the customer leaving the company just because the rep left or changed, never. Right? They still use it.
Yep.
I mean, I've had 15 reps at Salesforce, still using Salesforce, you know, so that's obviously not the issue.
Do you feel like sometimes reps want to, like, even if you communicate that out, I still feel the propensity for reps to be involved so much in it, and I so much involved in the implementation and just the ongoing support of an account. One, I
think, so if it was your business, James, if it was your business, James, why would you allow that?
It's not my business. That's what I'm saying. No. I'm observing, similar to what you're dealing with, I have the same mindset. I'm just sort of putting this out there. I feel like reps constantly are involved in it, and their underlying reasons are, one, they just don't know what to do with themselves, and two, I feel like in certain cases they may have oversold.
I think I would be kinder to reps. I would say in many cases they're involved in onboarding new clients and solving clients' problems because they have to be. It's because the organization has been implicitly designed based upon an assumption that salespeople will be involved. Now, what needs to happen is the leadership team needs to say, okay, we need to redesign operations so that not only is there no involvement for salespeople, no reason for salespeople to be involved in operational tasks, but so that two more conditions exist. There are two more critical conditions. The first is that the operations team has to be able to perform those tasks that previously salespeople were performing at a higher quality, significantly faster, at a significantly faster velocity. And the second condition is we need to engineer the organization so it becomes impossible for salespeople to get involved in operational tasks.
Isn't there another one, though? It's also, you got to make sure what the salespeople sold we can deliver on. So there needs to be a pretty, because sales reps sometimes, you know, they're, especially when you have purely hunters, they're going to sell at all costs, especially when they can just.
So in an engineer-to-order environment, I mean, that tends to happen in an engineer-to-order environment where there's some ambiguity and there's wriggle room for salespeople. But in an engineer-to-order environment, we would stipulate that a representative of operations must be the one who's responsible for detailed requirement discovery, and they must have ultimate responsibility for the design of the solution. We would never give that responsibility to salespeople. The reason you employ, so if the question I always ask audiences is, what do you think salespeople's superpower is? And the answer that people give me instinctively, if they don't think about it, is they say, well, building relationships. But then when people think about it, they realize that salespeople's superpower is persuasion. If you've got someone whose superpower is persuasion, why the hell would you make them responsible for the design of a solution that your engineering and production departments have to execute? I mean, that's absolutely the wrong attribute that you would want in a person responsible for solution design.
So how does it happen that way? How do companies, like, you know, I think, well, I don't know, maybe you don't start out with the purest of motives, but how does it get that way? How are the companies that work with you believe enough to say, yeah, we're going to like fundamentally change what everybody thinks?
So it got that way because we evolved from the Ray Kroc model, the founder model, you know, the arm's length rep driving around with a bunch of inventory in the trunk, flogging it in the boondocks. That's what business evolved from. That's what sales evolved from. And business transitioned over time from, you know, make to stock, which means the rep can load up the trunk of his car with stuff to sell, to make to order, which means that the stuff that the rep's selling hasn't actually been made yet, so the rep has more degrees of freedom, to engineer to order, where the stuff that the rep is selling hasn't even been designed yet. And nobody thought to question whether or not the salesperson should be retaining responsibility for all the promises they're making. So if you're selling a Mixmaster machine, it doesn't make sense, and you're the salesperson, it doesn't make sense to argue to the customer that this machine can do something that it can't, because it's pretty clear to the customer what the capabilities of the machine are. You know, you only have so many degrees of freedom. But if you now keep the same model, if you have a Ray Kroc style individual in his jalopy pitching a customer on a custom solution that hasn't yet been engineered, then there are no checks on what they can promise. Now, the second part of the question is, how do we convince organizations to make the change? We don't convince organizations to make the change. We convince CEOs to make the change.
Well, so how do you do that? I mean, that I guess that's the...
By having them listen to a conversation like this. You know, you get two... If you have a senior executive, a particular CEO, particularly a founder CEO, listen to a conversation like this, you'll get one or two reactions. One reaction is, fuck me, this is painful. I've got a headache. Get me out of here. Get me a stiff drink. The other reaction is,
that's what Pete's face looks like right now.
Yeah. Oh my God. The other reaction is, fuck yeah. Mm-hmm. This is obviously how reality is. Get the troops together, put them in a boardroom. Mm-hmm. I just had an insight. We need to re-engineer our organization before our competitors figure this shit out. We sell to people who think like that. We don't sell to anyone else.
Amen. Amen. Guys, we're at time. Anybody got anything left in the tank?
Yeah. Oh, God. This is really great.
I love this man. Justin, I love this man. Justin, what's the best way a CEO that's currently still a CEO, how do they get a hold of you and your services?
Well, I'm easy to find online. If you Google Justin Rothmarsh, I have a blog at Ballistics. Sorry, I have a website at ballistics.com, Ballistics with an X. I have a blog at salesprocessengineering.net. You can find me at justinrothmarsh.com, or if you just type Justin Rothmarsh into Twitter, or, you know, I'm all over the place. Easy to find.
Well, you are totally Sassholes approved. Yeah. Vouch for your services, your books. Used you twice. Cases and cases of books. Go get this guy.
Excellent. People have been calling me something that sounded like that for a long time. I thought they were saying something different, but I realize now they've been saying Sasshole all along.
That's right.
Yeah. That's right. Same with us.
Good for you.
I feel better about the human race now already.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for listening to the Sassholes. On behalf of Jason, Jamie, and myself, Pete, we thank you for listening and ask you to please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. Smash that like button on Facebook, Instagram, and follow us on Twitter. Cue the non-copyrighted music. Justin, thank you. Thank you a lot.
Yeah,
oh,
that was
my
great.
God.
You're welcome.
We are going to share the shit out of this,
love
man.
It. Pete.
Yo, what's up?
How you doing?
Good.
Excellent. Big shoe today. It's good.
I was talking to Justin earlier. He's in the background. Having his
Hello,
hot
Justin.
Tea, getting ready. He'll pop on. We have him contracted in 2 minutes, so we're gonna leave him.
That's good. I mean, you gotta have boundaries. You gotta have boundaries.
That's right.
So how many podcasts you got going, big guy?
I got about 4.
Nice.
Rogan's taking a little heat, so Spotify needs a little help. I'm gonna
try
to help him with his missed episodes. Oh, here's Carney. Okay, oh great, he made it. Yeah, Carney.
Yeah.
Karnak.
There he is.
Nice to have you, man.
Thanks for
Justin.
Hey.
Okay,
hey, Justin.
Hey, how you doing?
All right.
That the glasses there, that's Jason Ferrara. We worked back in the day together. He's a marketing guru, just so you know.
Hello. Guru is... I was talking to somebody the other day who believes that guru is a dirty word, so...
Oh, really?
Let's see. Yeah.
Every word is dirty when you use it in isolation.
I like that. I'm gonna write that down.
So Jason's on the marketing side, and then we have the guy with the hair there. Jamie Carney there. He's a financial savant. Is savant a better word?
Sure. That's what you want to call me. I've run a lot. I've worn a ton of different hats, from product to finance to RevOps. You know, but
well, with that hair, you have to wear quite a few hats.
Speaking of hair, I wanted to congratulate you on the beard. I'm impressed, Pete. I meant to say before.
Oh, are you talking about the Burt Reynolds the
mustache?
Yeah, what was that cop show? Something Blues.
Hill Street Blues.
No. The one about the New York cops, NYPD Blues.
Oh, yeah.
Reminds me of.
No, I think Hill Street Blues is a better example. it is a beard from the 70s.
Pete is also known to stand in front of a group of people and say, be careful out there. So Hill Street Blues is his jam.
Okay.
This is a weak attempt to besmirch me. Try harder, please. So we have Justin on, and how many books did I hand out? I know both of you guys, I gave you a machine book, didn't I, back in the day?
Yeah.
I bought crates of them and handed them out trying to spread the word, Justin, and here we are.
Yeah, they were popular gift. They're like Sade records in the 80s.
Well, no, I never used them when I was... I never had that book playing when I was in college and with a romantic interest. Sorry.
Yikes.
You had a romantic interest?
I was going to say.
Not really.
I didn't think that was happening in Milwaukee.
In Milwaukee, how much did it cost?
It's just one night done, buddy.
Although the dorms in Milwaukee, you do pay by the hour.
Just so you know, they rarely get a chance to make fun of me. So.
Exactly. The romance is cheap. It's the recovery that's expensive.
Yes.
All right. Okay. Now we got that out of the way. This asshole's got that. The power of editing will make that sound really even better. Okay. Welcome to the set. Jamie, do you want to do the opening or should I do the opening? I didn't.
You can do the opening again today.
Are you sure? Okay.
I've been swamped, so I haven't been able
to. All right. We'll edit this out in post, along with everything else.
The whole opening.
And listen to bits throughout it. But the editing was good.
All right. Yeah. I'll take that.
It's raw.
We are raw. We are the
Sassholes. We're just trying to get out there and do that.
Hope you want to be a raw Sassholes. That doesn't sound comfortable.
You should put it in your descriptor.
Justin, thank you guys. We don't want to take. You're on the clock, man. Go make that money.
All right,
all the best.
Bye.
Bye, guys.
Bye.